You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 372 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Fire and Ice, Welcome to Smallville number 6, Birds of Prey number 6, Batman number 142, Poison Ivy number 19, Shazam number 8, and Bodies, season 1, episode 3, all in good time. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news, James Leach publicly questions whether DC Comics has begun enlisting AI art in Batman. In a March 10th thread on X, Leach noted numerous potential reasons why he believes that DC Comics may very well have utilized AI-generated artwork in the current Batman run. Now that I've read all the issues of Batman that Andrea Sorrentino contributed to, Leach wrote, I feel like there's a pretty strong case that AI art is being used. I'd love to be wrong about this, especially as the run has been so great, but it's hard to avoid. And the issue in question is Batman 143, which we haven't even reviewed yet, Cletus. It's coming up on our schedule next week.
Yeah, you know, Drew, I think it's one of those things that probably inevitable at some point that AI art becomes commonplace or at least more frequently used in comic books. I certainly hope it doesn't become the norm because you certainly are going to lose something. We talk a lot often. Some of the best comic book art, it's not about the technical skill, although that is certainly part of it. It's also about how they use the comic format and enhance the readability. And I just don't think, again, I think AI is at a point now where it can, relatively speaking, you know, replicate art, but I don't know that it's at a point where it can consistently be at the top for storytelling through artwork. And I'm sure, you know, technology will continue to evolve and we may get to a point where it does do it better. Who knows? Regardless, if you're doing it, you got to be honest about it. You would hate for DC or whoever to be trying to pass off an AI's artwork as their own. That is not for me.
Yeah, I agree with you there on that. Well, I'm curious to see if we notice it when we review Batman 143 next week. This week we're reviewing Batman 142, and I don't think I didn't notice any AI art in it. If I remember right, though, I didn't care for the art that much in that issue.
We can talk about it. It alternates art styles because I think we're looking at two different timelines, and depending on when we're seeing the story, the artwork is different. Yeah, I'll be curious to compare what we read this week to the issue that's really being scrutinized, to see if there's any discernible difference. I wonder, though, if the accusation is generally just this arc in general. I don't know. I am curious to look at it to see maybe what he's seeing, whether it's true or not. Again, I would prefer that we have real artists doing it. I just personally think that that's better. But if I'm not, like, you know, morally opposed to AI artwork, but you do need to be honest about it. But really, though, I have to be honest, especially DC and Marvel seem particularly likely to switch to that at some point because it's cheaper. You don't have to pay an AI, and they can work on a much tighter schedule. You can be pumping out issues. You know, I have a lot of artistic concerns about, you know, technically we're getting the same thing, but are we really getting the same thing? You know, and I don't know. That's a whole other conversation, Drew, but again, if you're using it, though, I think you need to be open about using it.
Definitely. All right, well, let's move on to our next bit of DC news. Over on Threads, James Gunn stated that Peacemaker Season 1 isn't canon to the DC Universe, and Season 2 will take place after the events in the Superman movie. So James Gunn is even saying that his Season 1 isn't canon. So really, everything is starting after the Superman movie.
Yeah, I am curious how confusing that's going to be. I think the average audience member is probably not going to know that. probably won't care either.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. They probably won't even care.
But I'm wondering, Drew, and I don't think that they should care. I don't really care either that it's canon or not. Was it a good season of television? Hell yeah, it was. That's all I care about. I think that's what most people are going to care about. My only thing that I don't know. I would assume Gunn would be aware of this. You know, I'm certainly willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. Is season two going to be a little confusing because, you know, it's operating as if season one didn't happen and that could leave viewers a little confused? That would be my only minor concern. Do I think that there should be continuity between the seasons? I don't really care. As long as season two makes sense, whether it's tied to the, you know, to the Superman film or not, I don't really care. As long as it's good and as long as it's not, like, confusing in that, you know, you're having a hard time figuring out, well, like, okay, am I watching, like, a completely different Peacemaker? What's, you know, as long as that makes sense, Drew, I honestly, I don't care. And I think most viewers won't care at all.
Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. And moving on to our last bit of DC news, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow writer Anna Nagura will also pen a Teen Titans movie for DC Studios, per report from The Hollywood Reporter.
I mean, cool. I wouldn't really hold my breath for anything until we see what happens with Superman, because if it bombs, we ain't seeing this Teen Titans movie. So I like that they're considering it. I like that they're working towards putting these films out, Drew, but I can't really get into it until I know that we're actually going to see those films.
They must be confident in her script for Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, to have her start penning a Teen Titans movie.
Sure, and they were also confident that Flash was going to be a hit, too. You know, they seemed fairly confident that Justice League was going to work initially, too. Like,
Mr. Pessimistic.
Drew, it's just the truth. DC is, this has not gone well. There's no real argument to be had there. I'm not saying that I think this will be bad. I've been on record saying I think this will go well. I'm very optimistic about it. But Warner Brothers' confidence in the project does not make me feel confident. They've been pretty confident in some train wrecks, to put it lightly.
That's true. But I'm more confident about it because James Gunn's behind it, so.
Agreed. No, again, we're on the same page. I agree. Just like we were talking about with continuity for Peacemaker, I kind of don't care what projects they announce until we have an idea that this universe is actually worth building around. I think it will be, but we don't know that yet. And so Teen Titans could be about whatever it wants. If Superman flops, it doesn't matter what that film is.
All right. Well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Attention, people of Earth! Looking for a way to kill half an hour every week?
Try the Flopcast! It's a silly podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, obscure pop culture from the 70s and 80s, and chickens.
Join us! Bring coffee!
We're on the ESO Network.
And we're at flopcast.net.
Check out the Modern Musicology podcast, where each week we talk about things like
what makes a great drummer,
our favorite rock documentaries,
songs we love by artists we don't love,
our favorite concert memories,
songs that should have been singles,
and all of our favorite music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now.
Do not use Modern Musicology if you're allergic to it. Modern Musicology may produce itching, dizziness, vertigo, temporary blindness, or heart palpitations. Do not taunt Modern Musicology.
Ask your doctor about switching to Modern Musicology.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers!
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 We got spoilers!
Spoilers!
For you! We got spoilers!
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 We've got spoilers!
Spoilers!
For you!
For you!
All right, let's talk. Fire and Ice, welcome to Smallville number 6. Rocky, wearing the creepy mask, has taken hostages outside the Big T's. Charlie throws an explosive at one of the limbs and frees Fire. Back at the hospital, Crave is upset that Ice hasn't shown up yet. He tells Martha that she is no more use to him. He's going to eat her. A boy comes running up to Crave and tells him to leave Mrs. Martha alone. Crave grabs the boy and tells him that if his mouth was full, he wouldn't have so much time for useless talk. Crave makes the boy hungry. Martha jabs a pin in Crave's eye and grabs the boy by the hand. Martha tells the mother to lock the door. She will be back with help. Superman is busy fighting Metallo in Metropolis. Martha tells him not to worry. The girls can handle it. Outside the Big T's, Elrond grabs the mask off Rocky's face. It doesn't stop her. Crave shows up and tries to take Fire hostage, but Ice defends her. Ice is going to kill Crave, but Fire stops her. Honey, along with Grodd's sister, use their powers together to tell everyone that eating people is gross and to stop this foolishness. Fire talks to Kui 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 and convinces the island to take over the abandoned Kawachi cave. Captain Underpants shows up, better known as Superman, and tells Fire and Ice, nice work. Fire and Ice fly off into the sky, ready for a fresh start. The end. I thought this was a very chaotic ending to this miniseries.
But a pretty chaotic ending. So it ultimately was a very chaotic series, Drew. I don't feel like it really wrapped up anything, really. Other than the Crave storyline, he gets defeated, but he really only pops up right at the end. So I guess in that sense, that arc is completed, but I didn't feel a satisfactory conclusion to basically anything, Drew.
Well, that Kui 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 Island is now in the abandoned Kawachi Caves.
Okay.
So that wrapped that up.
I guess.
They didn't really wrap anything up with Rocky herself, or the brother.
I didn't feel like they really fully did anything with the fact that one of the was it Beefeater was killed. I know they kept referencing it, Drew, but I don't feel like that fully was adequately resolved. You know what I mean? Like one of the other villains murdered him and ate him. That's just that villain now. You're just leaving it. You know what I mean? Like they just left it that.
Just kind of left it. Yeah.
And the like everything with Smallville, the whole trying to build the salon. They just leave. Okay. So what? So now what? The other lady just owns it now, I guess.
Yeah, I guess they didn't really say, did they? This kind of.
And Fire and Ice, I don't feel like they fully talked out their own issues either. It just sort of felt like this whole series, Drew, it felt like they were like, it never felt like they fully knew what they wanted to do. They just kept kind of throwing crap at the wall and seeing what stuck for an issue. And then we're just like, and we're done now. What were we doing? What was the series about? I mean, it was, I guess, nominally, you could say it was Fire and Ice, you know, discovering some issues and rediscovering themselves. But I don't really feel like they did rediscover themselves, Drew. I don't know that they fully talked through any. But the thing is they didn't really have issues with each other and didn't seem until they got to small. Like, this miniseries manufactured the issues between those two. And then I don't feel like fully resolved them and then just sort of, like, waved their hands and are like, all right, we're done here. What a mess.
Yeah, I guess I have to agree with you. It was a mess. So I retract my statement because you're right. Nothing really got resolved in this. They're just moving on with leaving a mess behind. I guess Superman gets to clean it up.
I was extremely annoyed with how they just sort of like, and we're done. And it just ended with Fire and Ice just flying off. I was like, what? This can't be how you end this. You didn't do it. It was a waste of everybody's time, Drew. This series did nothing. I don't need dramatic stakes. I don't need massive continuity changing things or character, like permanent character altering things, but just give me a story. Give me a complete story arc. And they only in the barest of terms, if you take Crave as the main story arc, which I would argue it really wasn't until about halfway through it, that's the only semblance of an arc that we truly have. Because Drew, how does it end? It ends with Fire and Ice flying off and being like, we've got to go, you know, figure ourselves out. Drew, that's why they went to Smallville, was to figure themselves out. And they're like, all right, we got to leave and go figure ourselves out. Wait, you just did that. You didn't do anything. I'm so frustrated, Drew, because there was a lot of potential with this series. I like the fact that it's a miniseries focusing on these characters, and it just wasted everybody's time. I'm a little bit frustrated the writer got the, like, you know, ability to write this, took it, like, got convinced DC, like, hey, let me write the book with these two characters, and then just, like, dumped this on it, like, here it is. Are you kidding me? This is the best we could do?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll be seeing another miniseries with them or not.
Well, that's my point, Drew. What a phenomenal way to make sure that these two characters don't get featured in another book soon. Just brilliant work.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Birds of Prey number 6, The Mascara. Megara has possessed Sin. Zealot stabs two swords through Sin, but she is not dead. Zealot's plan was to force Megara out of her, but it didn't work. Sin and Megara are bonded together. Batgirl has the urn. The Birds of Prey open the urn and start drawing Megara into it. Because they are bonded, it will also bring Sin. Dinah decides to put on the lid before Sin is trapped. Using the Lasso of Truth, Sin forces Megara to let her be in charge of her body. Wonder Woman verifies that Sin is in charge and warns Megara if any harm comes to Sin, or if she tries to harm the world beyond, Wonder Woman will come for her. Using the Mega Rod, Barda boom tubes the Birds of Prey back to Gotham City. The Birds of Prey celebrate with drinks, though Dinah, on the inside, knows this is not a win, but a compromise. Batgirl Barbara Gordon shows up and is upset with Dinah for not asking her on the mission. Dinah replies, it's complicated. Dinah confronts Meridian about Barbara and asks Meridian why she wouldn't let Barbara come on the mission. Meridian states that it was actually Dinah's decision because the 11 previous times they tried the mission, Barbara died, every single time. Meridian explains that someone from the future with tech similar to hers wants Barbara dead. After Meridian leaves, Batgirl Cassandra Cain confronts Dinah, apologizing for spying. Cass states that she is going to stay with Dinah until they know that Barbara is safe. Next issue, new team, new mission.
Drew, I loved the twist at the end that I don't know that we knew that the time travel had been involved in this story. At least if they had, I had forgotten that detail. That made the ending so much more satisfactory. Like, I to be clear, I enjoyed, you know, the climax, the conclusion of that conflict and how imperfect it was, you know, without Sin being saved cleanly. But then that reveal that they had tried this, you know, tens if not hundreds of times before, and every single time Barbara ended up dying, and sometimes some of the other Birds of Prey also died, and that this was the first time that they actually saved Sin and that no one else died. Extremely effective storytelling device, Drew. I loved that reveal. That made me even more, you know, interested and intrigued as to, you know, where this story goes next than I already was. Just a phenomenal conclusion to the arc.
I agree with you. And the Meridian character was pretty mysterious throughout this first story arc. I mean, we kept seeing her briefly in places, but not really. Didn't feel like she was really involved in the team. Then when we get to the reveal at the end that they tried this 11 times, she's got some sort of time travel tech. And I'm like, whoa, that makes sense. And it also makes sense why Barbara wasn't on the mission. Because, you know, she's been a part of Birds of Prey since it started back in the 90s. So that got me really intrigued on what is going on. So, you know, there's something bigger happening here. And I think that's awesome. I really enjoyed this first story arc, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, me too. Like I said, I was already pretty satisfied with the conclusion to the story to begin with, but then that the time travel reveal and the time loop aspect to it where they kept trying this repeatedly. Oh man, Drew, you know I'm a sucker for that kind of story to begin with. So like as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, they know me so well. Like I said, I've really, really enjoyed this series quite a bit, and I didn't think it was possible for them to hook me even more, but my goodness, did they do it.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I was totally wrong about this Birds of Prey series. Remember, because I was a little pessimistic about it at the beginning.
Yeah.
So I am very happy to report that I was wrong. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman number 142. A woman is taking out the trash. The Joker comes up behind her and covers her mouth. Shh, it's just me, Sally. I got caught up in some terrible things, so I could give you the life you deserve. I can fix this. Just wait for me, Sally. The Joker runs off. A man steps out of the house. Jody, are you okay? Who was that? The woman replies, I don't know. 6 months later, Joker is sitting in his apartment, naked and staring out the window at the rain. There is a bang on his door. The landlord shouts that the rent was due 2 weeks ago. The Joker shaves and gets dressed. Someone in the Red Hood gang must have betrayed him. Detective Jim Gordon gets harassed by Police Commissioner McLode and Detective Gabris for his friendship with Batman. Commissioner McLode tells Detective Gabris, you don't poke a problem, you solve it for good. Wearing makeup to hide his white face, Joker is drinking in a bar called Flunkies. Joker mouths off and gets into a fight with a bunch of patrons. Right when the Joker is about to kill someone, a bald man calls him boss and the Joker stops in his tracks. Joker recognizes one of his Red Hood gang members named 22. They leave the bar together before the cops show up. The Black Hood gang hits a jewelry store. As they are getting away, Batman jumps on their car. A few minutes later, Detective Gordon and the GCPD find the men tied to the hood of their getaway car. Detective Gordon has a talk with Batman, who states the Red Hood gang is still out there, and that is his priority. He doesn't think their leader died in the chemical vat because there was no body. 22 stops for a burger. Joker waits outside. Joker freaks when he sees Batman swing by in the sky. Joker runs. He runs all the way to Gotham River until he sees Ace Chemical on the other bank. Joker drops to the ground and stares at his reflection in the water, calling himself a coward. A man appears behind Joker, stating he has been following him around for months now, and he is impressed. The man states he can train Joker to harness his mind and never feel fear again. He trained Batman. In the present, Duke is infected and his powers are absorbing all the light, plunging Gotham into eternal night. Everyone is infected, an audible virus spread by laughter, and everyone in the world was Joker. To be continued. I did not like this issue, Cletus. It was...
No, it's terrible.
It felt unclear whether we were... Well, I mean, I kind of figured it out that we were in the past, but it like started out... I think it started off in the present, jumped to the past, went back to the present, but it didn't tell us it was doing that. And then Dukes of Powers were infected and absorbing all the light. You couldn't show us that happening or how it happened, and... Everybody's a Joker at the end of the... It was... I didn't like it. I didn't care for the backflash story either about the Joker. I felt like there was something I was missing. And that was one of the things I was going to ask you. It referenced Batman Zero Year, which when I Googled it, it looked like it was from the New 52. And it was Grant Morris... It looked like it was a Grant Morrison story from the New 52.
No, it was a Scott Snyder.
Oh, Scott Snyder. Okay.
Zero Year was Scott Snyder's, like, I don't know if it's not, I don't, my memory of it isn't that it, Batman has been Batman, but for a very short amount of time, and Riddler takes over the city. Essentially, and it kind of, there's two parts. There's a Zero Year part one and two, and there's like a conclusion, and then the villain sort of, I can't remember if it either switches to the Riddler or it starts as the Riddler and switches to someone else in part two. That I can't remember. I've read it and I've got them on my shelves, but it's really good. It's essentially Scott Snyder's version of Year One, you know, which is, which we've talked and reviewed before, you know, Batman kind of getting started. And we know Zdarsky did his version of Batman becoming Batman in the training era. So, yeah, Zero Year is effectively like Batman just getting started in Scott Snyder's version.
Okay. Did you have to read that to know what was going on in this, though?
He didn't really mean anything to me, to be completely honest with you, Drew.
Okay. Okay, at the beginning of the issue, we saw the Joker come up to that woman and call her Sally. It made me...
That felt like that was supposed to be from The Killing Joke.
From the Killing Joke? Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was from...
sort of gives a... what I think Alan Moore intended to be an unreliable narrator version of Joker's origin, but a lot of people have taken it to be the gospel, which I genuinely don't think is what Alan Moore was going for. I feel pretty confident in that. But a lot of people, Drew, a lot of writers have taken the Killing Joke to be, like I said, the gospel, the what Joker's origin is, which is fine, I guess. But that's, I mean, because they literally have the Killing Joke scene where he's going crazy looking in the water, seeing his reflection for the first time.
Yeah, and, I did notice that.
Yeah, and then I think that's supposed to be him, like, right after going, like, don't leave me, essentially. But, man, Drew, it was just narratively, it was really hard to follow because we were looking at two different timelines, and then the Joker is going crazy. And so it's hard to follow what he's doing, you know what I mean, and what exactly is happening. There also, we got this is the thing, again, where I was confused at what the comic was doing. This comic, again, recognized that there had been multiple Jokers, but it felt like they tried to fix that and make that up. Just kidding, there really is only one, because he killed the other two in this current version. I couldn't tell for sure if that's what it was trying to do, or if it was, again, an unreliable narrator, if he's going crazy, what. But you see the shot of there being, again, the Killing Joke scene where he's looking in the water and realizing what he's become, right? But then you're looking at it from behind, and there's another Joker walking there, and that's as Batman is acknowledging that there's supposed to be more than one of them, right? That something had happened and created three. And then we see Joker strangle himself. Is that literal, Drew? Are we back to just one?
Again, I don't know.
It was so hard to follow what was really going on. And I know that part of it is Zdarsky trying to show that the Joker is losing it, right? And going crazy. But also, again, this is my, sometimes my problem with some portrayals of the Joker is they want to have their cake and eat it too. Where, like, he's absolutely crazy, but then he's also the greatest mastermind of all time. And it's difficult for it to be both. And I know that that's, you know, some people can like it that way. For me, Drew, like, if you want him to be a genuine lunatic, which is what this comic seemed to be going down, where he was, like, losing it, he can't be a mastermind because he's too crazy to to be that level. What I prefer is the one where, like, he, you know, feigns it being a lunatic, but there's that, like, what makes him more scary is that he's rational, right? That he's doing all of this absolutely insane, heinous things, but he's on purpose, right? That he knows what he's doing and he's doing it anyway and has a plan. Everything he's doing has a purpose. That's far more terrifying and effective as a villain. So again, that's subjective. That's my personal taste. But I would have preferred something like this, because, like, this, Drew, is just, I just was like, well, what are we doing? Like, where are we going with this? And then we get the jump forward, and it feels, again, Drew, my problem with the flash forward is it feels like it's setting up a story where Batman has to kill the Joker. And we know that he won't do it. So my patience for these kind of stories is about as thin as it's ever been. Like, I'm just exhausted with us writing yet another Joker story that yet again puts Batman in this, like, impossible position of, do I kill him or do I not? Do I finally cross the line? This is the thing. This is the thing that pushes me over the edge, and I'll finally cross that line, but then he doesn't do it. And it's like, of course he's not going to do it. Why? Pick literally anything else to do with the character.
Totally agree with you. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Poison Ivy number 19. Pamela Isley tells her mother that the only school that has the kind of biochemistry program she wants is in Seattle. Pam's mom warns her that there are a lot of older guys who will see an eager young girl as an invitation. Pam makes several friends at college, Philip Sylvain, Alec Holland, and Linda Holland, but she gives up her social life to study more and spend more time learning from Dr. Jason Woodrue. Dr. Woodrue gives the class great news that they have been funded for the next round of experiments. Dr. Woodrue chooses Pam and Linda to assist him in the first phase. He tells Philip and Alec that it is important to promote women in sciences. Pam and Linda are working in the lab when Dr. Woodrue comes in shouting at the women that they were supposed to be done 2 hours ago. Dr. Woodrue shouts that he will do it himself. He tried to help women like them, but all they are doing is proving to the world that they do not have what it takes. Dr. Woodrue comes into class one day and unveils Brassica audentia, a plant that reacts not only to changes in light and temperature, but also to sound of human voices. After class, Pamela chases down Dr. Woodrue, excited they are bridging the gap between plant life and animal life. Dr. Woodrue invites Pamela back to his office, and the two make out and more. After that, things get weird. Dr. Woodrue invites Pamela to the docks, where he shows her his secret laboratory. He states this is where the real breakthrough is happening. He has been diverting some of the grant money here. The others aren't ready to see it, but Pam is, and he calls her his perfect little flower. Pamela throws herself into her work. She stopped going to class because there was too much to do at the secret lab. Sometimes she didn't even go home to sleep for days at a time. Every day felt like one step closer to something revolutionary. One day, Dr. Woodrue comes to the secret lab and wakes Pamela up. He informs her that the university refused to give them another round of funding. Pamela needs to use other methods to get the supplies they need. The university, 2 nights later. Pamela has decided to steal supplies from the lab. Pamela believes that this is the moment when Poison Ivy was born. As she is leaving the lab with the supplies she just stole, a security guard stops her. The guard demands that she stop and drop the backpack. Pamela runs. Next issue, Origin of Species, Part 2.
Drew, I really enjoyed this flashback issue quite a bit. I really like this version of, you know, seeing the origin of Poison Ivy start to unfold and kind of seeing how she fell into the trap, so to speak, with Dr. Woodrue. Really, really good. And very believable, too, right? Like, that didn't feel outlandish that something like that would happen. Yeah, just a great flashback issue, Drew. Again, it's really incredible what they've been able to do with this series. I know it was just originally designed for 6 issues, but the fact that it's been able to keep going and that they keep finding new, really interesting stuff to go with it is so impressive for, again, a book that wasn't supposed to go past 6. Like, they didn't really need to plan out ahead at all. Really good stuff, Drew. This has been a very strong series for Poison Ivy.
It has been. I really enjoyed this issue, too. And I liked seeing this more in-depth origin of Pamela. Because I think we got, I think it was towards the beginning of the series, maybe. We got a little short origin story of her. But I like this more in-depth one where we're kind of digging in and seeing more in-depth of her origin. And it's very interesting. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week. Shazam number 8. The Captain and Black Adam's fight has demolished Billy Batson's home, his family's home. The Captain asks Black Adam, "Is this how the head of state behaves?" Black Adam answers, "My state is none of your concern," and flies off stating, "We will speak of this no more." The space dinosaurs give the Captain 1 ungorks, or 57.03 minutes, to deliver their auditor, or the consequences will be felt planet-wide. The Captain tells Billy's family about the battle with Black Adam and that the house has been destroyed. Billy's dad tells the Captain that he wants to talk to Billy. The Captain transforms back into Billy. His dad informs him that things are worse than being homeless. Once the foster agency learns that the house has been destroyed and there is no permanent residence lined up, they'll have no choice but to take them all away. Meanwhile, the space dinosaurs deploy pamphlets over the Earth asking for their auditor to be surrendered, or they will bomb the world with a mountain of paperwork. Billy transforms back into the Captain. He flies the auditor and Darla to meet the space dinosaurs. Darla starts asking the Admiral questions. While Darla is conversing with the Admiral, the Captain flies to the Rock of Eternity. The Captain asks Zeus to rebuild his house. Zeus tells him no. Black Adam shows up and convinces Zeus that rebuilding the house is the right thing to do. When the Captain returns to the space dinosaur ship, the Admiral begs the Captain to take Darla away. The Admiral agrees to let the auditor stay. When the captain flies Darla and the auditor home, their house has been restored, a little bigger than before. Epilogue 1, The Royal Palace of Kondok. The captain thanks Black Adam for his help and tells him that he owes him one. Black Adam states there is no debt. He simply honored the nobility of the throne, as is his responsibility. Their business is finished. Black Adam adds, the next time the captain strikes him will be his last. Epilogue 2, The Family Home. Mr. Tawny is trying to fix dinner, but can't find one of his spices. He's tired of people rummaging through his cabinets. As Mr. Tawny walks away, three mysterious eyes stare out from the cupboard. Next issue, The Creeper.
Drew, I have to admit a little bit of hypocrisy on this. This was a very clean ending to this story, a conveniently clean ending. But I can forgive it because that sort of fits Captain Marvel in a lot of ways, especially for the kind of Shazam Captain Marvel story that Wade is going for, where that more old school type of book, you know, kind of storytelling. And for that kind of aesthetic, that this sort of relatively happily ever after ending is effective. Again, for the kind of story and the kind of storytelling style that they've been going for. I will admit that is a little hypocritical. But again, I think I don't think it would work if they were telling the story in a different way, or if they were going for a different, you know, a more modern type of story or something like that. But given what they're trying to tap into and the kind of era of Captain Marvel Shazam that they're trying to tap into, it worked.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I'm wanting to see more Black Adam.
Yeah, I agree. I liked the version that we got in this. We got the hothead, but we got the other side too, where this isn't the pure evil Black Adam, right? This is the ruler of Kondok and the one that is trying to be better in his own way, right? And you get those little glimpses of why he was made a champion in the first place, depending on what version of Black Adam we're going for, I guess. If it's New 52 one, that's a different story. But regardless, I like the type of Black Adam that we got in this story, where, again, he's a little reckless. He's certainly a hothead, but his primary focus is, as always, Kondok, an undercurrent of heroism. Not overt heroism like The Rock, but... Again, that sort of undercurrent there of like not doing the right thing necessarily in the best way or in the first place, but eventually in a very roundabout way kind of getting there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this version of Black Adam. And I'm wondering what's in Mr. Tawny's cabinet. They said the next issue is supposed to be the Creeper. Are we going to get the Creeper we know, or are we getting some alien thing they're calling the Creeper?
Yeah, that's a great question, Drew.
I was curious because I noticed the whatever's in the cupboard has three eyes. So I'm guessing that's what our next story is going to be about. I'm enjoying this run of Shazam. So,
yeah, I agree. I mean, especially because Wade is doing a great job of just kind of going for that very old school, very straightforward. This is the story arc. This is the story that we're telling, and not the like multiverse worth of stories that Johns was trying to set up. I still think Johns could have done a good series on Shazam, Drew, but he was so focused on like the arc, five arcs from now was what he was like trying to set up, and we just weren't spending enough time actually telling the story in front of us. This has been much better in that regard because it's entirely focused really on basically just telling that story. Obviously, you know, there are little teases and foreshadowing things, but for the most part, it's a much more straightforward comic.
Right. And it seems to be pretty much focused on Billy. I mean, we have his siblings involved in things, but for the most part, it's just focusing on Billy. We haven't even seen that much of Mary and Freddie either. Of course, right now we know Mary's off helping the Amazon. So that might be another reason why Wade hasn't included her much in the story, because she's off doing other things. But yeah, I'm enjoying this. And I'm glad. I thought it was hilarious that he took Darla to question the space dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And by the time he came back from the rocket journey, the Admiral had enough. He was like, get her out of here. I found that freaking hilarious. But we also saw another side of Darla. She was angry at Billy for destroying the house and wrecking the family. So I'm glad Billy was able to fix that, even though it was pretty much Black Adam that fixed it for him. It was really Black Adam that convinced Zeus that it was his responsibility to fix that. So, yeah, really good story. All right, well, that wraps our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk bodies.
All right, monkeying around, start talking. About your podcast.
We talk about an Emmy-winning comedy series.
We talk about a band who outsold the Beatles and the Stones in 1967.
Still sticking to that story, huh? Well, if you know what's good for you, you'll change your tune.
We talk about a groundbreaking multimedia project
that inspired generations of artists and fans.
All right, throw the book at them.
This book is overdue.
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
As the temperatures get cooler, let's think back to a time where monsters fascinated our young minds, where haunted houses and flying saucers were the stuff of fantastical dreams. Come relive those wonderful times with us every Monday at 5 p.m. It's Monster Attack on the ESO Network.
And we're back. Let's Talk Bodies, Season 1, Episode 3, All in Good Time. 1890. Inspector Hillinghead and reporter Henry Ash meet up on a Sunday after church to investigate where the man in the picture was hiding. They find an indent left by the suspect's cane and can see the cane is hexagonal, indicating it was custom made. There is only one cane maker in this area for high society, Dalrymple and Sons. Hillinghead introduces himself as Archie Cartwright and his brother Ussus. The cane maker refuses since it's Sunday, but Hillinghead gives him a secret handshake. The cane maker is able to provide an address from his records, no name. Hillinghead and Ash go to the address and discover the man in the photo is Sir Julian Harker, one of the wealthiest men in the city. Harker spots Hillinghead and Ash looking at him. Harker gives Hillinghead a friendly head nod. 2023. Elias Mannix, 15 years old, is now wanted for killing a cop, D.C. Rick Williams, but also likely for the murder on Long Harvest Lane as well. Detective Hassan is given police protection for her family since Mannix threatened that her son, Gerard, was next. Detective Hassan wakes up in the middle of the night to find her son's Nintendo Switch on and the Mario music playing. Mannix comes in through her window pleading with Detective Hassan, stating he didn't do it, but they're going to make him say that he did it. Please believe him. Mannix is arrested. 2053. Detective Maplewood takes Professor Gabriel Defoe to see the other Professor Defoe she found on Long Harvest Lane, who was shot in the eye. The professor checks his own arm and finds no marking. Suddenly, the Defoe who's on life support starts convulsing, and the medics are unable to save him. 1941. A little girl has brought in a flyer of Inspector Goodman into the police station. She tells Sergeant Whiteman in Yiddish that she wants £10 for her silence, or she will tell his boss that she saw him in the lane, putting the dead man in the car, but in English. Sergeant Whiteman replies if she does that, then he'll snap her neck like a chicken wing. But the girl calls his bluff by saying the words ice cream in English. Somewhere away from the police station, the little girl is upset that Sergeant Whiteman has only given her £2. A nearby payphone rings, and Sergeant Whiteman answers it. The mysterious woman tells Whiteman he must take care of her permanently. Sergeant Whiteman tells the girl to meet him back here at 10 o'clock tomorrow. They have to drive to his mother's house in Essex, where he keeps his money. 1890. Henry Ash tells Detective Hillinghead that Sir Julian Harker was believed killed in action on the front lines in Burma, but he returns unexpectedly alive to his mother, Lady Agatha Harker. That was the story they were allowed to print in the newspaper. The house staff informed them that when Harker returned, he did not look like her son at all. Lady Agatha was so desperate to have her boy back that all the portraits were repainted in the house to look like him. Harker is so good at the stock exchange, he was never found out. They say his mother's seances tip him off, and the two are often consulted by powerful people for investments. The awkward truth is the predictions are often spot on, eerily so. It's made Harker so rich, he's about to buy a private bank in the city. He's protected. There is a knock at the door. A man asks if Inspector Hillinghead is in residence and hands Henry Ash an invitation. Detective Hillinghead wonders how they knew he was there. Hillinghead reads the invitation, and it's for a seance tonight. 2023. Elias Mannix intends to confess to both murder on Long Harvest Lane and the planting of the firebomb placed with the intention of killing a police officer. When Detective Hassan questions him about the murder, he doesn't have any information. 1941. Sergeant Whiteman is driving the girl into the country when someone starts following him. Sergeant Whiteman is able to lose the car. The little girl finds chloroform in his glove box. Sergeant Whiteman uses it on her, digs a grave, and then shoots her in the head. 2023. Elias Mannix agrees to talk to Detective Hassan alone. He tells her that Andrew and Elaine Morley know things. They are the ones that took the pictures. 1890. Inspector Hillinghead attends the seance at the Harker's residence. When asked what spirit he wants to talk to, Hillinghead states he wants to speak to the spirit of the man who was shot, stripped, and left to die in Long Harvest Lane. He wants to know if the man in the photo, the man that killed him, is Sir Julian Harker. When the spirit supposedly appears during the seance, the inspector asks him his name. Automatic writing produces the name Defoe. When he asks for the murderer's name, Inspector Hillinghead passes out because his wine was drugged. 2053. Detective Maplewood asks Professor Defoe if he can explain why his doppelganger and he have identical DNA. 2023. Detective Hassan gets Elias to talk to her underneath the table away from the cameras. Elias tells her that the Morleys stated there is a bomb that is going to kill hundreds of thousands and that Detective Hassan is going to make him plant the bomb. 1941. Sergeant Whiteman is at home when he receives a call from the mysterious woman. He tells her it is done and hangs up on her. The little girl wakes up on Whiteman's couch. Whiteman gives her the money and states he needed to make it look like he killed her because he was being followed. 1890. Inspector Hillinghead wakes up in the grass. He makes his way back to Henry Ash's apartment. Hillinghead tells Ash to hold him while he sleeps off the drug. When Hillinghead wakes up, he and Ash become romantically involved. 2053. Commander Mannix tells Detective Maplewood that the body in the morgue is no doppelganger. It's Defoe from the future, 2 days from now, give or take, judging by the scar. If Chapel Perilous can send someone back in time, then they can do anything they want. They can erase their progress or destroy the whole world. Commander Mannix commands Detective Maplewood to follow Defoe, find Chapel Perilous, and know that she is loved. 1890. Inspector Hillinghead returns to the alcove in Long Harvest Lane and scratches his name on the brick with his knife. 2023. Detective Hassan returns to the alcove also and finds the brick with Inspector Hillinghead's name on it. Man, there was a lot in that episode.
Yeah.
It was very good. Very really packed good. With stuff, but very yeah. good.
Yeah, yeah. Any concerns that we had that this show wouldn't be able to maintain the momentum for the first episode, I think are pretty safely gone now. Man, Drew, I'm hooked every episode. It just hooks me so quickly again. And I can't wait to find out what happens next, you know, within the episode that we're watching and then, you know, coming up next week. And it's great, man. It's got that just perfect level of intrigue where it's drip feeding you information. You're like, oh, I can't believe that just happened. What's going to happen next? And oh my gosh, that just happened. Man, it's just really entertaining. And we got some interesting developments. We finally saw the better side of the World War II era cop.
Sergeant Whiteman.
Sergeant Whiteman interacting obviously with a fellow Jewish person, not wanting to kill a child. Starting to see the other side of him that you could kind of see was probably there. He wasn't a straightforward villain, right, in the first two, but was clearly willing to do some questionable things. So seeing the other side of him start to emerge is cool. Seeing Hillebrand being the arguably one of the bigger focuses of this episode was very enjoyable. I've particularly enjoyed that era. That's probably just personal taste, but that's just been more fun when we've been in those time periods. And him carving that into the rock, it being found in 2023, Drew, it's starting, you know, I mean, obviously time travel is factoring into this, but I'm wondering now if we're actually getting two separate, like, competing time travel schemes, where we've got some sort of evil scheme, right, that's been set up to set up this dictatorship. That seems pretty clear, right, that that's in some way, some sort of, you know, long-term plan has been set up for that dictatorship to sort of rise to power and take control. And I'm wondering, potentially now, Drew, if there's a separate one that's competing against it, so to speak, to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, it does seem like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. And if not, that's fine, too. I'm so interested in what's going to happen next. Man, it's so good. And I've just, all four of the main characters are interesting. There's really cool things about each of their stories. So I don't feel like, obviously, I'm, you know, there's one that I prefer a little bit more, but it's not because any of the other ones are bad or not good. That's what makes it so fun, is that you can jump to any one of these four time periods and you're like, ooh, okay, what's going to happen now with this one? Like, it's exciting every time it does that. Even, I'm sure everybody has their personal favorite detective that they like, of course. But what's great is that all four of those storylines have interesting things, and it doesn't feel like you're like, ah, okay, all right, we got to go back to the future, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, that's what makes this show so strong, is it can jump back and forth between those. And I love the dual screen. I know I talked about it in the first one, how it really kind of, I thought, was adapting the comic, you know, the way comic books work, and doing an interesting sort of adaptation of that onto the screen. I love that we keep getting it, Drew, and I have personally found it very effective in storytelling for this show.
The other thing I like about the series is every scene is important for moving the story together. I got to tell you, when I've done notes on other stuff we've watched, I don't have this much, it doesn't feel like I have this much detail as I've had in this one. And, you know, sometimes I'll skip stuff if it's not as important or whatnot, but it seems like every single detail in this I need to include in my notes, because it's important to moving the story along. So it's not like they're putting in scenes we don't need. Everything is pushing the story together, or pushing the story forward, and is important to the overall story. So they're not putting in any wasted scenes in this. It's all packed full of stuff we need to know. I also like how it's jumping between the different years. So, like, if there's one year you don't like more than the other, or another character you don't, you're not just stuck with that character for a long period in these episodes. You're getting these short snips back, going back and forth. So very interesting. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah, so one thing that we didn't mention, talking about Birds of Prey, I don't remember, Drew, if we knew this before, but the Meridian character is Mia Mizoguchi, who we have read in a couple different stories. She was in the Gotham Academy comics that I think we've either referenced or read a couple issues of. And then she was also, Drew, the Robin with quotes around it. And I think it was one of the backup stories for Detective Comics. I don't remember where it was, but it was an ongoing mini series within a different book where she was at Gotham Academy, and Bruce was investigating murders bodies that were washing up in the river. And she's the Asian girl that sort of helps him along in that.
I vaguely remember that.
So that her friend has been kidnapped, and she's trying to find this girl and is trying to get Batman to help. And they do eventually resolve it. And she has her own Robin, like self-made Robin costume that she puts on at some point in that story. It was really good.
Oh, yeah. I remember that story now. That was a pretty good backup story.
It was very good. Yeah. And again, so she first pops up in Gotham Academy number one, which came out in 2014. So during the New 52 era, and she's been a part of that, like, Gotham Academy stories. There's been multiple comics, obviously Gotham Academy, Robins, I think We Are Robin also dealt with that. The backup story that I'm referencing, that's who that Meridian character is. She's referred to at towards the end of the story. Black Canary calls her Maps, which is what, you know, like her nickname, what she goes by. And I don't recall, Drew, I can't remember if we knew that or not. I think that was a reveal. It's possible that they told us at the beginning and I didn't process or I didn't remember it. But I found that very interesting because this is obviously a future version, an adult version of that character. And I thought that was really cool. So again, this character, Maps, first appearance is in Gotham Academy, number one, but has again popped up in other stories as well. Again, including the Gotham River Murders. I mean, I don't remember what comic that actually appeared in. It was a backup in the Batmans. It looks like at least one of them would be Batman number 121. So I don't know if that was the first issue that popped up in. But again, so backup to the Batmans in the 120s area was that Gotham River Murders storyline that both of us really enjoyed. Just cool. Really cool that that's a character that we've seen recently. And now we're getting this kind of different future version of that character. I'm liking that a lot. Just another thing about Birds of Prey that's been really appealing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about Detective Comics number 168 from February 1951. It is The Man Behind the Red Hood, the original origin story for the Joker. So I think I've shouted out about it before, but I want to shout-out about it again since our Batman issue was about Red Hood Gang, and this is the issue it came from. So, classic story. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message, text us, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Blue Beetle, Action Comics, Batman, Green Lantern, and our next issue of Bodies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
You're ready to move off.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.